This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Michigan League for Public Policy President Gilda Jacobs discusses Governor Rick Snyder's proposed budget, as well as the human cost of infrastructure. But first, West Michigan Republican power broker and school choice advocate Betsy DeVos is now the United States Secretary of Education. We're going to talk about what that could mean for charter schools with Gary Miron. He's a professor in Western Michigan University's Education Leadership Research and Technology Department, and he has extensively studied and written about charter schools. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks, Gordon.
So give me, first of all, just the overall reaction. Betsy DeVos is now Secretary of Education. What do you think that may mean for charter schools across the country?
Well, I think it's good news for charter schools, and I've heard from a number of people about these large companies that are own and operate charter schools that now have expansion plans. So I think we could see a more rapid expansion of charter schools across the nation.
Now, a lot of people have said, look, the Secretary of Education has limited power, especially when it comes to K-12 education, so don't necessarily look for big changes there. Look more at things like higher ed. Do you think that's the right way to read this?
Well, I think with this administration, we think about a lot of things. We think about how things should happen, how the transition will work. And when we look at the Department of Education, rationally, we know that the Secretary of Education does not have much authority, in part because the amount of money that the Department of Education has isn't that great. And most of it is devoted to special education and to the college loan system. So, on the one hand, rationally speaking, she doesn't have that much authority, but I think we can't expect things to be done rationally. I think we have to expect things to be different or expect the unexpected. So my expectation is that she's going to leverage the authority that she does have to affect wider sweeping change and also to push more the decisions about education to state levels, whether that's special education or civil rights issues and their enforcement, and push that to local or state levels where her and her husband also have a great amount of influence in those political arenas.
The DeVos family is seen as largely responsible for the big growth in charter schools in Michigan because of their advocacy, because of their political contributions to members of the legislature. In the Detroit Free Press, a column from Stephen Henderson written that got a lot of circulation after Betsy DeVos was nominated for Secretary of Education said that in Detroit, parents of school-age children have plenty of choices thanks to the nation's largest urban network of charter schools. What remains in short supply is quality. Is that a fair assessment?
That's a fair assessment, and her thinking, and I think we can expect to see this in her exercise of authority, is she's not a believer in oversight and regulations. She wants to deregulate, have less oversight, allow the accountability that she believes in is market accountability. So with charter schools, if they're not doing well, she has a belief that it's they'll remedy themselves. And
people will stop going there and they will go out of business.
And our evidence suggests just that that's not necessarily the case. And there's anecdotes we can cite, some closures and so forth due to drops in enrollments. But mostly what we see is two struggling systems, and the charter system and the public school system, that are struggling and failing and having, you know, the same amount of money now split between two systems, and both of them struggling and failing. That's what the research evidence is indicating.
Are there other states which have charter school systems and have different levels of accountability which are getting different results?
There are, and when I look at nationally, and we've done a lot of state evaluations of charter school reforms for state education agencies, and a couple of them, like in Delaware and Connecticut, our reforms have suggested that charter schools can work. And what's unique about these states is that they focus on quality rather than quantity. They focus on charter schools as being as improving traditional public schools by example. As it turns out, they end up having fewer charter schools, more selective processes. And those states that tend to have that type of model and that belief behind them tend to have more bipartisan support for those charter school reforms. States like Michigan, Ohio, Arizona are kind of in a different camp, and they are more prevalent today. But these states The thinking behind them has been more partisan in nature, but also the thinking is we can improve public schools through competition. So create as many charter schools as possible. Don't worry about quality. Create the hurt. When the public schools are hurt, then they'll shape up, then they'll respond. I've heard one person even say from the American Enterprise Institute, the problem with charter schools in states like Michigan is that we haven't hurt the public schools enough, that we have to cut to the bone, then they'll finally respond. And that's pretty scary to think this thinking. What we see in the research actually shows what happens in these schools when there's increased competition for limited numbers of students is that the district schools lose the most resource-rich families first. And after they lose between 6% and 7% of their population to schools of choice or charter schools, the public schools tend to go in a negative spiral, that they don't have the economies of scale and the efficiency to actually lift themselves up and compete because they have fixed costs and other things that are involved. But actually, the evidence suggests that cutting to the bone is not going to force the public schools to react positively. It's going to just put them into that negative spiral.
Newsweek noted that the two Republican senators who ended up voting against Betsy DeVos's nomination for Secretary of Education came from Maine and Alaska, which both have large rural areas. Maine is actually considered, according to one estimate, the most rural state in the country. Is that a problem for rural areas, that they do not have the same options for creating charter schools, that when you have areas where there's only perhaps one school, you can't afford to bleed off all the students or half the students from the one school in that town when there may not be another one for several miles?
Yeah, choice as we know it with limited markets where families can choose from different schools, it's not viable in rural areas because the distances are too great and the numbers of students are too small for different competing schools to exist. So we don't see a lot of choice in Alaska and even many of the rural areas across our nation. But so those two senators weren't supportive of her in part because their constituents they don't envision school choice. They don't see why it's relevant to them. But I think what you'll see with the new Secretary of Education is that she will be pushing to provide choice in rural areas, especially through these very controversial online charter schools. And her husband has been a big investor in K-12 Incorporated, which is the largest operator of these virtual charter schools. And it's a very controversial company, in part because their results have been disastrous. And they've also been very heavily involved in lobbying and purchasing influence and policy arenas within states. So I don't know that he's still invested in K-12. She says that she doesn't have conflicts of interest, but we can't verify that.
The last time you were here, I believe we talked about online education, virtual schools. What is the problem with the basic idea that if you are in a remote area, and if you are someone who cannot easily get to the public school because there isn't one for several miles, or the one that's near you is not very good, what's the real problem with the idea that, hey, maybe an online education source could be better for you than what is offered in your immediate area?
Well, the problem with it is not the idea. The problem with it are the outcomes across the board. Universally, every outcome we look at is extremely negative. The children are losing ground. And many families are choosing this option, especially since at the urging of their youth who see the advertisements on Nickelodeon and elsewhere. It sounds exciting to be at home studying on your own. I happen to believe that the model could work, and I think it might be suitable for a smaller number of students during particular parts of their school career. But what's being peddled now and the model that's being pushed is a corporate model, and it's based on profit. And I think that's our problem with these schools right now is the outcomes. The idea is good, and I think it could provide a viable option. I believe in the future we're going to see more and more of the blended learning options that will reach these families so they don't have to be transported every day to a school at a great distance. But I think the big problem today is that everybody that is doing research in this area, we all agree that there's a serious problem and the outcomes are disastrous.
When Betsy DeVos was nominated for Secretary of Education, Bridge, the online news service of the Center for Michigan, ran a series of articles. Some of them were stories which they had done previously, which they then put back on the site. They quoted you in a story noting that the outcomes we can measure show it's leading to increased segregation. This is the growth of charter schools and increased burdens for districts. How do more charter schools lead to them being more segregated?
Now, back in 2010, we did a national study looking at what we called schools without diversity, and nationally looking at charter schools and how the populations, the demographics of the students compare with their surrounding districts. And we found that only a quarter of the nation's public charter schools had similar populations of students as their surrounding districts. And by similar, we mean within 10 percentage points in terms of the percent minority or white. And when we looked at special education and English language learners, we saw enormous differences, where we saw about four dozen charter schools in a nation that have very elevated numbers of children with special needs. Most of them have very few, and the children they serve tend to have very mild disabilities, where the children with moderate and severe disabilities are concentrated in public schools. So these charter schools are serving as, people would argue, the charter school establishment argues, they may be segregating, but it's not the charter school's fault. It's the parents are self-segregating. But charter schools are clearly providing a vehicle for accelerating segregation in our nation by race, by class, by ability, by special education status, and by language of instruction. And that's something that's been verified in a national study by the Civil Rights Project, and also in the state evaluations that we and others have conducted over the years. That's a consistent finding, is that charter schools accelerate segregation. And so I think I think the current administration is not going to be concerned about that. I think that's something that's quite acceptable in their mind. So I think we can see charter schools, the growth of charter schools, to increase, and what I would say, we have segregation already. What they will do is accelerate the segregation that exists.
Through policies which just encourage the growth of charter schools?
Yeah, with the growth of charter schools, we'll see increasing segregation by those categories I mentioned. So, and that's, I mean, the two things that charter schools have been used as vehicles for, one is accelerating resegregation. The other is privatization, where we've seen that they have become a vehicle for privatization, where I know John Engler early on pushed for charter schools. I think he believed in the vouchers, but didn't pursue that, didn't agree with Betsy DeVos on that. But I think he has had a vision where charter schools could become private schools. In Michigan now, we have just over 90% of our schools are privately owned and operated, charter schools. So, and that's something across the nation we're seeing now. Close to half of the nation's public charter school students are now enrolled in privately operated charter schools. A good portion of them are nonprofit companies, but in Michigan, about 80% are for-profit companies. And we don't see a large difference between the nonprofit companies and the for-profit companies when we look at their contracts, the performance agreements, and also the management fees that they pay.
Do you think there's something that is fundamentally wrong from a public policy standpoint with allowing somebody to come in and run the school in a for-profit manner?
Oh, Gordon, back in 2002, we did a book. It's called What's Public About Charter Schools? And Chris Nelson and I, he was at Western at the time when we wrote this book. And it was kind of to talk and to share with other states the lessons from Michigan, where we were already pursuing a lot of privatization through charter schools. And the lessons being that, you know, we should look at oversight mechanisms. We should look at incentives to help ensure that charter schools pursue their public, you know, pursue the public good, the public interest, rather than serve private or corporate interest. And I think at the time we had a number of recommendations for legislation that could tip the balance in terms of the public-private good that the charter schools could serve, even if they are privately managed. We argued if you had the right incentives in place, or had the right oversight mechanisms in place, we could still ensure that these private operators would work for the public's best interest. I think looking back at that now, we were perhaps a little naive, not understanding how the policy formation process works in our country, where more money, like the DeVos money, can purchase influence rather than rational thinking or the notion that legislators can put in place rational ideas about oversight when they still have to fund their campaigns. They still are dependent on donors like the DeVos family. So what we've seen is many other states are following the path of Michigan now, with charter schools becoming predominantly private actors and serving private goods rather than serving the public's best interest or the public good.
And the real problem that you're spelling out there is that it's a for-profit institution without the strong accountability measures that you spelled out now 15 years ago.
Yeah, it's a private entity, but they also don't follow the policy intent. The charter schools were supposed to be small, locally run, innovative, highly accountable schools. They would be given greater autonomy. But this idea that was embedded in the policy and in the legislative intent, they're not pursuing that. They're pursuing other outcomes. They're pursuing outcomes that lead to greater segregation and privatization. Those are not part of the legislative intent. So when these private actors are pursuing private outcomes or private good, they're not fulfilling that the publicly established goal that they were supposed to have, although they are publicly funded, receiving all of their funds from public sources.
Gary Miron, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Gordon.
Gary Miron is a professor in Western Michigan University's Education, Leadership, Research, and Technology Department. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The Michigan League for Public Policy has not always agreed with Governor Rick Snyder's ideas for taxes and spending, but the organization that focuses on addressing poverty says there is much to like in the governor's proposed spending plan. But there's also a warning as lawmakers begin debate on a new budget for the state of Michigan. Gilda Jacobs is the president of the Michigan League for Public Policy. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, how are you this morning?
I'm fine, thank you. What do you consider the most encouraging proposals in Governor Rick Snyder's proposed budget?
Well, there are actually quite a few very encouraging things in the budget. But I think probably the most important one is that the budget is upholding the continued funding for the Healthy Michigan Plan. As you know, the Healthy Michigan Plan really gave 600,000 Michiganians with low income health care for many of them for the first time. So this is huge. This is really, really huge. The governor, from the beginning, really understood not only the importance of doing this for low-income residents of the state, but also, you know, he understands the economics of doing it as well.
So what are the economics? I mean, certainly there's a certain human part of this where you say, well, people should get health care. Why is it economically beneficial, do you think, to the rest of the state?
Well, before we actually had the expansion of Medicaid as well as the Affordable Care Act, so many low-income people were having their health care taken care of in the emergency rooms. That is really not a very good way to provide access to medical care. And I believe that the hospitals have saved something like $300 million in uncompensated care by being able to have the people that are coming in, you know, have insurance, and then not using the ER room for their treatment.
So your statement also says that this budget proposal helps leverage federal funds for state services. This is maybe a little technical, but can you maybe explain to our audience how this works?
Well, there's actually, you know, a couple of areas that are really great in the budget that address that. If the state puts up money for certain things, then we're able to draw down other federal funds. So Heat to Eat is a program that allows us to draw down money for low-income people for food assistance. And, you know, we're going to be putting up just under $7 million in order to do that. Also, there's other child care funds that we're able to secure by putting up a state match. And the governor has put in $8.4 million in state funds in order to do that. You know, when we don't do that, one, we leave money on the table that actually other states use. But, you know, these are really, really important areas for Michigan. You know, we want to be sure that that folks that need food for themselves and their kids are getting it. And also, the child care system in Michigan, unfortunately, does not get very high ratings if you compare us to other states. And if we want to make sure that their parents are going to work, and that they can leave their kids in high-quality, safe child care situations, then we really have to be able to kind of put our money where our mouth is with this. And we're really able to do that with this extra funding.
What does the governor's proposed budget say about the priority of education in Michigan, in your opinion?
Well, there are a couple of areas that we really feel are really good. There's an increase in school funding for at-risk kids. You know, what that does is it really shows the commitment and the understanding that it really does cost more to educate kids who are at risk, who are living in poverty, who, you know, are living in some really adverse conditions. So it recognizes that. So very, very pleased with that. There's additional money for high school students, additional money for K-12 as well.
So as I said at the beginning, there's a warning in here, and the warning is if lawmakers go ahead with a proposal which is out there to cut the state income tax. Why would this not be good as you see it?
Okay, well, I think the important thing is that was not in the governor's budget.
Correct,
so sometimes we celebrate what's not in the governor's budget. You know, if we take a look at other states that have done this, and Kansas jumps out, you know, Kansas tried to do this, and then all of a sudden, they really had buyer's remorse, and there were severe consequences. So in other states that have done that, and they figured out, oh my gosh, we don't have the money to help support essential services, you know, like infrastructure, like schools, they've turned around and found other ways to tax their residents. And that's what's going to happen here. You know, you can't starve the beast so much. And the governor recognizes that, has not put in any kind of tax cuts. So the concern is, where is the legislature going to be coming from with this? And we've already seen some proposals that have us quite worried, quite honestly. And we're going to be studying this very carefully, messaging about this all the time, because we really feel that this would not be a good thing for Michigan. We don't want to see any kind of repeal or rollback of the state income tax.
Now, part of the argument that people are making for an income tax cut of some sort is that Michigan's revenues have been going up quite substantially. And I guess the argument they would make is, why shouldn't some of that go back to the taxpayers?
Well, I think we can see, if you use Flint as an example, that sometimes really bad things happen that you don't plan for. So if you give back all the money and you don't have money either put in a robust rainy day fund or putting it right into infrastructure programs, you're going to end up coming up short and not having the money to address emergencies. Think about your own budget at home. You know, if you were to have a major problem with your home and aren't able to, have the funds to take care of it, you're going to have to go out and, let's say, get a loan and pay, a lot of money in interest, because the problems aren't going to go away. And just because today we have, an extra $300 million, it's at one time. We don't know if the economy is going to collapse again in the future. One of the proposals ratchets back the income tax, the state income tax, over the next 40 years. Believe me, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know what we're going to be faced with in 5 years or 10 years, let alone 40 years. And I think it's really unwise of legislators to put in a system of taxation where they are no longer going to be accountable for the results and what happens. You know, we're going to be probably, many of us are going to be dead and gone in 40 years when, the chickens come home to roost. And I just don't think that this is a very smart, strategic way for us to be setting up tax policy.
The Michigan League for Public Policy does a lot of work examining what is best for people who are at the lower end of the income scale. But a lot of those are still working families. Could they use some tax relief?
I think there's a philosophy out there where we have to figure out where are our priorities as a state. So whether you're low income or middle income or, a higher income, there's certain things that are taxes are good for the public good, whether they're parks, whether they're roads, whether there's, certain public health kinds of things. So taxes are not always a bad thing. They really provide the dollars to make sure that we have a quality of life that is important for everybody. So I think we have to really look big picture when we take a look at taxes.
So on the subject of taxes as well as infrastructure, which you mentioned a moment ago, you recently wrote about investment in infrastructure and the tragedy that your family experienced now almost 2 years ago. For our listeners who are not familiar with this, would you please share that with them?
Sure. My daughter, Rachel, was on a train for coming back from Philadelphia to New York. The train careened out of control. The train derailed. My daughter and seven other people perished, died because of this. Another 250 people walked off, many with injuries, but still were alive. The tragedy of this is that the technology to have stopped the speeding train was not put in place on that train. The technology was there, but some decision was made at some point by Amtrak not to have it installed on all of the trains. And yet it was supposed to be there, could have been there. Had it been there, would have avoided this horrible, horrible, tragic accident where my daughter and seven others died for no reason. They didn't have to die. And if you really, you know, this is obviously more complicated than just having that technology installed, but you can really connect the dots to how important infrastructure is to the very lives of the individuals that use our roads, our trains, our bridges, drink our water. There's a clear connection that there are people behind these decisions or indecisions. And, you know, it's very easy when you're a legislator to, you know, look at data, look at numbers, look at charts, to say, oh, we can avoid doing this for now. We can wait until later. Well, the fact is people's lives and their families are affected forever when certain decisions are not made or put off. And unfortunately, you know, what happened on that Amtrak train could have been avoided if that investment had been made.
And you also make that connection to what happened in Flint, which is a different type of infrastructure, but is an investment in infrastructure.
It's really exactly the same kind of a situation. It didn't have to happen. You know, decisions were not made that would have changed the trajectory of the lives of kids and seniors and other vulnerable people that were drinking from that water system.
Are you trying to get people to think about this in a different way? Because I think when people think infrastructure, often it's roads, and then the question is, oh, do I need to get an alignment now? Or do
right.
I, if we had a better road, I might not have to get an alignment for 6 or 9 months. I mean, are you trying to put these issues in a little more of a human context and maybe a little more urgency around them?
Exactly. I am trying to put this human face onto the budget decisions that we make. They're just not numbers on a chart. There are human beings involved when we make these decisions or don't make these decisions and these investments. And that's really what I'm trying to do. You know, I've not written anything or really been very public since my daughter's death, but when I see this now conversation going on in the state to repeal the state income tax or ratchet back our taxes, I can't help but think about what happened in my family. And I think we have to talk about this out loud, and that's why I've done this, and that's why I'm becoming, you know, public on this, because I want legislators to understand the human faces that are behind these decisions. And, you know, what happened with Flint, I mean, a lot of very talented journalists, you know, helped to make that human connection. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people say, well, that's Flint, and, you know, we've done so much already, you know, with Flint. But the fact is, it's not just Flint. It's what's happening all over the state when we don't make those investments. So it's way beyond just what happened in Flint. It's, you know, where are we as a state? What investments do we make going forward as a state?
Gilda Jacobs, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Gilda Jacobs is the president of the Michigan League for Public Policy. A link to Gilda Jacobs' post on her daughter's death and investing in infrastructure can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.